à Cocktail Nation Lounge spécial.
Lynn Stanley joins me on the show. We've played your music for quite a while, and I thought, let's get you on the phone. You know, Lynn, when I was doing my research on you, I was amazed because your beginning in jazz is a little bit different to other people's, and that you're a bit of a late starter. Tell me about that.
I did not know I could sing professionally or even as an amateur, really, until 2010. I was at a concert where Paul Smith, Ella Fitzgerald's piano player, was playing. And I really didn't know him, but I listened to him after a few minutes. I thought, man, this guy is really good.
Yeah.
And I was kind of way in the back of the open air outdoors. It looked like a wedding setup, kind of, you know, with the little white chairs and an ocean view and a stage. And I just kept moving myself closer and closer to look at him because he had a major case of osteoporosis, right? And I just knew he was older. So I got close and listened and watched his fingers and all. I was amazed. And it was a small little venue. It was a fundraiser. And I had the opportunity to go up afterwards, which I've never done in my life, and introduce myself to him. Because back then I was just about to become a U.S. champion and international champion ballroom dancer.
Right.
And I was really, well-tuned, as they say, even the touch of a hand, I could get a lot of information from someone by touching a hand. So I had the opportunity to, I stuck my hand out to shake his and said, I just think you're marvelous. I just kind of giggled like a little girl. And then I understood, I found out who he was afterwards because David Benoit introduced him and they really didn't have a flyer out for people as you entered into the concert.
Yeah.
So David Benoit introduced him. His name was pretty easy to remember, Paul Smith. So I went home and Googled him, and wow, the guy's got credentials like Tommy Dorsey, Sarah Vaughan, Frank Sinatra, Benny Goodman, Bing Crosby. He played for everybody. And he worked with Sammy Nestico as well. And I had read about him a little bit further in the article. It said he was going to be playing again at that same hotel, only in the lounge. And I thought, how odd, someone this caliber would be playing in a lounge at a local, it's a beautiful resort hotel, but it just seemed odd.
Yeah.
But I said, I'm going to go. And sure enough, there he was at the appointed time. And there weren't many people there at the very beginning. And I went up to him and I said, here I am again. And I said, I really, really like what you do. And I don't know if I can sing, but I'm about ready to retire. And I thought maybe I'd go apply for a church choir position. And I don't read music. Never had a music lesson or anything. But I thought it'd be smarter to meet with someone who does know about it to tell me either give it up or go get a gardening job or something else. So I gave him my card and I asked him if he would please give it to his wife, and he did, and she called me a few days later, and they lived literally within a mile of that location, and so I went to their home, and it was so big it had a studio inside of it with two grand pianos, and it could seat 100 people for a concert. And
why
then
did
it was
he
also,
leave? He could just play there.
You would think, huh? Yeah, but when I went in, I'm at the door and I'm going to have to sing for somebody, and I got very afraid.
Yeah.
But fortunately, his wife culturally was Lebanese, and they're very gregarious, and so she was cordial and invited me in, and a lovely woman. She was the voice of Ava Gardner in the movie Showboat.
Really?
Her name is Annette Warren-Smith. And so they brought me in. He kind of knew I was nervous, I think, and so he sort of backed out and kind of went away a little bit. I think he was hiding kind of in the back. But she had me come in, and then she did the usual questions that one might ask if you're a teacher, right, in music. And she said, let's begin. Can you do scales? And I just looked at her with cross-eyed, going, no, I don't know what that means. Those aren't fish. You know that? I have no idea what you're talking about. And she just went on and a few more questions like that. And finally, she said, well, can you sing something? And I said, well, I know a lot of pop songs, but I do know one that I bet you know. And I said, I know The Man I Love. I've always thought that was a beautiful song. And she said, okay, what key do you sing it in? And I said, oh, my God, I don't know. And she just kind of threw her hands up in the air, and she said, just start singing, and I'll figure it out. And so I said, okay. So I started to sing, and there I am looking kind of at her but trying not to look at her, and she's playing. And she's at her bench. I'm standing near the piano, and she stops after about 16 bars and gets up. And she was a small, petite woman. And I'm taller, and she came up, and she just looked up at me, and she said, and, you know, you don't know if you can sing? And I said, no, I really don't. And she, are you kidding me? Lovely Lebanese women, they just sort of get in your face when they think you're spoofing them. And I said, really, I don't. I've never had a music lesson. I don't have any clue. And she said, well, you can sing. And so from that on, they took me under their wing. And within 4 months after training me, I was on stage with Paul Smith. Took me out the first time.
You must have thought this is such a steep learning curve. I mean, to go from not singing to into a performing scenario on stage, I mean, that would have been terrifying.
It was. You know, luckily for me, I had done enough ballroom dance competitions. I think other people who might have gone through that same experience, I was hiding, obviously, yeah, behind a pro, because I won 3 titles as a pro-am dancer. So I was used to being in front of people, used to being judged, but I was hiding behind a taller man, and if I made a mistake, they usually made up for it. But there you are, naked, practically in front of people, and no one's going to hide behind you or hold you back. Or if you make a mistake, it's all on you, and you've got all these eyes looking at you. It was pretty. I had to go to another place. Believe me, I was sweating bullets when I went out there. But she had told me originally she was going to sing also that night. And then she came up to me, which the added pressure, she came up to me the day of the performance when we were just beginning sound check. And she said, oh, by the way, I have laryngitis in some of my notes, and I'm not going to be singing tonight. It's only going to be you.
Do you think she did that deliberately?
I don't know. I was just, oh, my God. I really kind of went crazy at that point. But, you know, if you commit to doing something, and she had said to me, you have the it factor. You know, she said, you're an attractive woman. You know, you've got a stage presence, and you are mature enough to know how to handle yourself. You've done enough with your competition and ballroom. So she said, you know, just rely on what you know and do your thing. And so I brought up my amateur ballroom dance partner because I also competed in amateur dancing in ballroom as well. And we did a little bit of movement steps from a tango or something like that on stage with people to show them that I had other talents, you know, if they didn't like my singing. maybe I like my dancing. So I did get through it, and I taped it. Because I thought, this will never happen again in my life. So I taped it, and then I happened to go back east to help my friend move out of a house, and I was doing yard work, and I was moving a big pile of dirt, and there was a quick storm that was coming in Atlanta, and I ruptured a disc in my back, and I was lying on my back in bed for almost 3 weeks. Yeah. And the video came, and while I was sitting in bed and couldn't get up, I was looking through the internet, and there was a open call entry for teaching you how to learn to put on a show done at Yale University. And it was a worldwide open call And so I asked the videographer, could you possibly put together a little 1 minute or 2 minute video of what I did with Paul and see what happened, you know, if I can submit that, and which is what we did. And I was one of 27 out of over 400 people picked to attend that program.
Wow. I mean, I'm just amazed by the learning curve. You've just progressed through, and even, you know, to the point where, you know, I know you now, what you've done. I mean, this is absolutely incredible. Had what you'd done in your working years, had this helped you at all?
Well, I am sort of a Renaissance woman in a way, because I had enough smarts that if I wanted to try something out, I would just a free spirit. I would say, I don't want to do that part anymore. I want to try this new thing. And so I tried many. I spent the first 10 years of my career in the advertising industry. Mm-hmm. I handled major clients, Hilton Hotels and other big companies in their advertising program. And then it became apparent to me back in those days, which was kind of the culture of Mad Men that you see on the cable TV show. That, you know, you had to get more experience, and I did work with McCann Erickson, which is one of the agencies they were all trying to get into. I did work for them, but eventually I decided I needed to go back and get more education. So I had my bachelor's degree in communications, arts and sciences, with an advertising specialization. But then I went back and got a master's degree, and I got a 3.9. out of a 4.0, and I submitted to one university for a doctoral program to see if I thought maybe I might want to end up teaching marketing and advertising courses throughout my career doing that. And I got accepted, and I began that program and did it for about 5 years, and I ended up getting cancer, or a pre-stage of cancer, and I decided life's too short to not do what you really want to do. And I had begun, for relaxation purposes, more or less, just begin social ballroom dancing, just to relax. And I picked up the knack for liking it so much. I really enjoyed it. So when I left the program, and I got a job with Fortune 500s as a strategic planner, and I was working for Bell South and some major companies, and I was doing customer strategies for them, and in the financial industry, the telecommunications industries. And then I just at one point decided, you know, I kind of learned what I want from these things, and I started flitting around. I wanted to learn about cap rates, so I went to take a job with making so much less money. It was amazing. But I learned how to do a commercial real estate appraisal.
Yeah.
You know, I just kind of flitted around. But when I came to the singing, this is the first time in my life everything just pulled together so naturally for me. And I haven't gotten bored. It never has bored me. If I do one project, the next one coming up has another tilt or something to it that just engulfs me. It's amazing.
I think it sounds very obvious to me that you're the combination of smart and beautiful, and you are clever enough to go, okay, what do I need to learn about this, and how am I going to get it? And then you just go for it.
Mm-hmm.
And that is just such a wonderful combination, because I know early on in your music career, you figured out that high-quality recordings were the key to success. Mm-hmm. And you were one of the early adopters of vinyl. I mean, this is a combination of everything you've learnt in a past life coming into music. And, of course, you're a great marketer. Now, you've seen this. You've seen the high-quality recordings necessary and important. And the fans really liked that, didn't they?
You know, I got a tip. When I was first starting out, I had the luck of the draws. It would be, I got a guy by the name of Tommy Vaccari, who is the engineer that does all the Oscars music, right, every year. Wow. He's one of the main, he's like the main guru guy. He ended up being the one I hired to do my very first album, Lost in Romance. The quality and the sound was so spectacular, and he would talk about that, about how he recorded, and I was from an audiophile father who we had, my mother on her second marriage, we had the big speakers and the major turntables. This guy was an executive with an oil company here in California, a high-ranking one, and so he had the funds, right? He had the Jaguar in the garage and the big stereo system in the house, and I fell in love with the music in our home compared to my friends, right, who just had little tiny players or nothing as elaborate. So when I was sitting with Tommy during that development of that album, I was taking it all in, and you can see from the history of my stepfather, I was kind of backtracking and listening to more of what I had heard when I was growing up about those things. And then I realized I was going to have him do the mix on it, and I thought to myself, look, if I'm going to spend this much money on a recording, and people tell me you're similar to Diana Krall, I went and looked at her albums and saw that Al Schmidt was her mixing engineer. Mm-hmm. And I didn't make Tommy happy, believe me, but I decided to hire Al Schmidt, and I sent him one of the tracks Tommy had done, and Al said, sure, he's a great engineer, I can work with his stuff. And so that's when my relationship with Al Schmidt came along, and Al worked with me all the way till my London Calling. That was my seventh, I'm on my 10th album, I think now, but London Calling. I had Steve Jenwick, Al Schmidt's engineer, do the recording part, and then I hired a guy I didn't know very well. I know much, much better now, who did record all of the famous Joni Mitchell albums, and he's a major engineer as well, by the name of Alan Sides, who happens to be also an audiophile, and he puts out pro monitor speakers. He creates them for people around the world, major studios, and so, you know, now I like, because Al Schmidt is a music guru, you know, music and mixing, and he has this magical thing that happens, but in his own home, and when it comes to audiophile side of things, that's not his forte, but it is in Alan's case. So I kind of hit Alan's all about sound, and he's won Grammys for the sound that he. So I latched on to Alan, and now he's the one I've been working with, and I did a direct to disc with Alan doing it, and that he didn't get scared or he was very prepared, and but that's a huge responsibility for someone who is doing the mixing instantaneously, and it's going right straight to a vinyl record. You know, God bless him.
It sounds like you've, as far as your career is concerned, you've taken it all very, very seriously, and that, you know, you've spent the money that you needed to spend. You weren't doing like a home recording or anything like that people often do these days. You know, you're going, you know what? Okay, I've discovered this. I'm all in, and I'm throwing everything at it, which is gutsy, because it's obviously, you know, it's a bit of a risk, but. But I think you have enough confidence in yourself that you go, you know what, I'm gonna make this work.
Well, when I did the direct-to-disc, that is an audiophile coveted a piece of work, a project. There are probably only 5 artists in the history of music, really, that have done a direct-to-disc like I did, which is 3 or more songs with 12 or more minutes. That singer was on every single song, with only a break for the musicians to do their interludes. That was gutsy, because I was ill. And if you really study music, now that I know it so much better, there are recordings, whether we like it or not, not to say it, but there are early recordings when everything was very raw and real that Sinatra and many other artists did, and they had notes that were flat. Okay, they weren't always perfect back in those days. Those recordings were so real, and I had to accept that what I was going to do was the way it was at that moment in time, and there was absolutely no fixes possible. Whereas today, I mean, in all honesty, I know one huge, huge star that works out of Capitol, and this person has 100 different breaths they can incorporate into the music for that person. 100 different breaths that they can change out. You know, it's just today's music is so, manipulated.
Yeah, and hermetically sealed almost.
Yeah, and I thought to myself, I'd rather have somebody, you know, beat me up alive and say, well, you were flat on that one or something like that, and but it be a real, I mean, I'm within the note all the time. But, you know, if you're not, if you're the producer and the singer, in the case of that directed disc, we literally had two sessions in up to 2 days, two sessions were planned. And on the very first day, the first session was lost entirely. Okay, so when we were doing the lacquers, side A and side B had to be done between 2 p.m. and 5 p.m. I had to go through 6 songs, and we did 2 takes on each one. And whichever disc had the better of the songs, that's the one we had to pick. But there was a pencil that got lodged inside the piano, and it kept the music from coming out of the piano.
Wow. Sparing the works, as they say.
I mean, it was on a Saturday, and there was absolutely no technician available. And so we had to wait and wait for somebody to come to finally help us. And there's a YouTube video that I told you about about it. But, you know, there's everything that can go wrong when you're doing things live, and it's very risky. But at the end of the day, I can say to someone, you know, you can have me sing and I can really sing. You're not going to have to fudge it and let it be at that. But when you go through programs like I have gone through as well, the training and the maybe, as you have said, maybe the research and the doctoral work and master's degree work training made me respect the industry. And one of the things when I went to perform in New York, you know, they told me when you do standards, there's almost in New York like a music police that if you don't do the exact words that were in the original compositions, you know, with the notes that they had prescribed on their music, it's okay when you go back in on a second round after you do your first round of it. But, you know, you've got to be so careful because they'll pick you apart if you don't know your stuff. So if you're going to be a student in music that's been done by these masters in the American Songbook, they want you to honor that. So New York gave me that lesson, right? California gave me the lesson of all these wonderful studio musicians that do so many films, and not so much a live jazz venue here in California, in Los Angeles. It's really not big like it is in other parts of the world. What we have here, though, are extremely active studio musicians who can read music really well and are extremely creative. So I got lucky dealing with those people who helped me. And honestly, I mean, I had tremendous people on my first album that were working for Barbra Streisand and Diana Krall, and, you know, they were Frank Sinatra. They were willing to work with me, probably because of Paul. Probably.
Yeah, that's amazing. What an incredible, incredible career you've had so far, and I know there's still a whole lot more to go. Do you ever wish that you'd gone on this journey earlier?
Oh, yeah, I do. But my mother was a practical Irish woman.
Yeah.
And my stepfather, my actual father, was the son of an opera singer out of Bulgaria. And when he was young, he had a knack to play piano and by ear. And he became a traveling salesman. And when he would go to different parts of the country, the story was that they would ask him to play because he could emulate Earl Garner and Art Tatum. And so he had some magic going on with him. But my mother was bound and determined that I was going to either be the president of a company or marry somebody who was.
Well, she, you know, she wanted to make sure you're secure, your future was secure. Yeah. Obviously, yeah. Didn't want you to be one of these arty type people, but little did she know.
No, she was. Yeah, she's one of six children in an Irish family that were very hardworking and very diligent and normal kind of jobs. And my mother was a nurse. She was not going to have that. So it took me a while to find this road that I'm on, and it's scary. I can tell you now that having now put together, getting out the concepts and delivered all these albums that I have put out since 2013. But I had last year a really good reinforcement. I got my stats from Spotify, which I generally didn't put myself out there in the streaming market up until now. But I was, to my surprise, and my music is in 76 countries, and I had over 300,000 minutes of downloads last year with them alone. And I thought to myself then, well, gee, you know, maybe I do have something.
I think you do.
But it's not just the, everybody always said, Joe, the audiophile marketing market is supporting you, but in the end, that's really not true, because they don't have enough people in there to really support someone in the long run without a second job. And I cannot afford, I don't have the time to work another job. No. So I have to, this is my work. I'm really, for real,
absolutely,
an honest to God singer. I'm trying new things. I'm coming up now. I'm trying to get out the door a Blu-ray 1080K that we did of a performance at Capitol in Studio A, and it's going to be a surround sound 5.1.
Wow.
So we put Dolby Atmos on it, 5.1, and I have these great musicians, and it was color corrected in Germany. It's going to be pressed over in Europe, and Alan Seitz did everything at Capitol, and Bernie Grenman mastered it, and so that's like, you know, a really big move and a big step expensive wise for me to do that on. Don't know if I'll ever do that again.
Sounds marvelous. Sounds like you'll be sitting right in the concert, which is, you know, it's fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to play one of my favorite songs. This is from your Interludes album. It's Boulevard of Broken Dreams. I've been a fan of this song for a long, long time, and I just love what you do with it. So we're going to play that tonight. Lynn, it has been an absolute pleasure talking to you. You're an amazing woman. I think I've learned an awful lot about the business of music and your motivations tonight. I thought we would just talk about music, but then, you know, suddenly you go in a different direction, which is just fantastic. So thank you so much for your time tonight. And keep on going, because you know you've got it. You've got something there.
I do appreciate it. I'm coming back to Australia again. As I told you, I was there in Melbourne and Sydney last August, and I will be back. I look forward to it. I would love to move to Sydney. Just heads up. If I can, I will. The next phase of my life.
We'll catch up when you fly into Sydney, as soon as those planes get flying again.
Yes, amen. Please take care of yourself as well, and thank you so much for helping me here.
It's
I appreciate your time.
Lynn Stanley
thank
and
you.
Boulevard of Broken Dreams of the Cox Nation.
Walk along the street of sorrow, the boulevard of broken dreams, where gigolo and gigolette can take a kiss without regret, so they forget their broken dreams. You laugh tonight and cry tomorrow when you behold your shattered schemes. And gigolo and gigolette wake up to find their eyes are wet with tears that tell of broken dreams. Here is where you'll always find me, always walking up and down. But I left my soul behind me in an old cathedral town. The joy you find here, you borrow. You cannot keep it long, it seems. But gigolo and gigolette still sing a song and dance along the boulevard of broken dreams. Boulevard.